Thank you, sir. I just wanted to just raise a question or the department's position around the list of questions that council circulated. Our experts have not had an opportunity to see that version, so they're looking at it now actively. But we've been asked to come back to parties by the end of tomorrow.
Yes.
I'm just asking if we need a bit more time and come back on the Wednesday.
Well, as I indicated this morning, I think we would rather receive a document that parties felt comfortable with being presented. If there is a difference of view about any particular aspect of it, I think we would rather that the difference was identified or articulated in the document. So we're not seeking for you to mediate the thing or to have to reach an agreed landing. Other than that, I don't think we're that concerned about the time issues. Thank you for letting us know.
Thank you, sir.
Any other housekeeping matters? Mr. Maths?
This evening,
Mrs. Edwards. Thank you.
The Bureau of Climate Supports Colin Maths. By Almighty God, that the evidence you are about to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hurst.
Afternoon.
So, can you please confirm from the court that your full name is Colin Thomas Hurst?
Yes, that's correct.
You're the Vice President of Federated Farmers National Organisation, and you are a mixed arable cropping and dry stock farmer exemplary.
Yes.
You produced a primary statement of evidence dated 28 July 2023.
Yes.
And that's found at Volume 304, Tab 4. Do you have any corrections that you would like to make to that statement of evidence?
No.
And do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge?
I do.
I have a document I'd like to hand up to the witness. So, Mr. Hurst, can you please confirm that you have before you a draft farm environment plan that was prepared by Balance?
Yes, that's correct.
And you received that on last Thursday, the 12th of October?
Yes.
And a copy of that farm plan has been provided to the parties by email on Friday before it was filed with the court, and no party has raised an issue with it. Just before I ask you to produce it as an exhibit, can you please turn to page 34, the second to last bullet point at the bottom of that page?
34.
And in that bullet point, that second to last one, it refers to a requirement to fence all beef cattle and deer on a slope of up to 10 degrees. Is that your understanding of this exclusion regulations?
No, that's an error. I've tried to contact Balance just to check on that, but they have notes on the phone. But just talking to people today, we do believe it should be 5 degrees.
So do you want to correct that to say 5 degrees?
Yes, so that needs to be corrected to 5 degrees.
And with that correction, could you produce that document as a draft Balanced Farm Environment Plan as an exhibit?
Yes.
I think that's exhibit 4 now.
Yes.
Thank you.
And just before I ask you to answer any questions my friends or the court have, were you here this morning when His Honour was asking Mr. Pennell questions about that farm plan?
Yes, I recall.
Is there anything, any comment you want to make about that farm plan or the context in which it was prepared or how it might be relevant in the context of Waikato?
Yes, I do. I think it's because we're a mixed arable farm, we have a lot of each individual paddock we have for cropping. And it obviously goes into a whole lot of detail around soil types and the different bespoke management schools each individual paddock, as opposed to a straight pastoral farm with a small amount of cropping, it would probably include a whole lot of this detail.
Just while you're on that point, is this a document that the Canterbury Regional Council requires to be produced, or is it or otherwise do they have any guidelines for how farm environment plans should be produced?
Or they do have it, it's in their regional plan, the specific requirements of the schedule, if I can't remember the exact
right.
But there is, but just to be clear, this I have asked Balance to produce me, it's the program they've got that's called Mitigator,
right.
I trained out of it, to apply to the national regs as a freshwater farm bank, so this is what we believe it should be looking like. And the other part of this, I have been funded through the Foundation for Animal Research to pay for this for me as sort of a test case. So, in Canterbury, I'm considered to be a permitted activity farmer, and we don't need this farm plan like this. There is a requirement to have a lower level farm plan to be available by the Regional Council.
But you say this would meet, as you understand it, Canterbury Regional Council's requirements?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst. Please remain seated and answer any questions my friend or the court have for you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hurst. Thank you for providing a copy of that farm environment plan. Very interesting to see it and read it. I just want to ask a few brief questions about that and how that all works. So, in terms of your farm, are you the primary manager of the farm?
Yes, I refer in my evidence that I'm like the chief executive, I suppose, of the farm. We have a farming company that leases the farm off the different legal entities.
Right, okay, and ultimately you're in charge.
Yes, yep.
And in terms of that farm environment plan, how closely did you work with the farm consultant that prepared it? How much input did you have? How did that all work?
I had a significant amount of input. So, basically they came out on farm and they questioned this, and it went over a period of days, and then there was obviously sort of throwing feedback to compile it completely. I did have a previous farm environment plan that helped feed into this. Obviously, the OECD report is included here as well, so that's obviously the fine detail on the farm paddock management detail.
Right. And do you think that detail kind of interplay would be necessary to have an effective farm environment plan?
I think so. I think it really serious about given the type of water quality we need to deal with the details to understand how we manage the different practices on our farms.
And as a sort of a working document, you'll become very familiar with it if you're not already, and you'll ultimately be responsible for implementing it and complying with it. Is that how it works?
Yes, obviously what we've got here is the plan development. From the freshwater farming context, we'll still need to get certified, so there's still more work to do. And then obviously the auditing of our particular actions we need to through the certification process, so there's still more work to do. So just to be clear, this is a draft. We're meeting with the consultant next Tuesday to complete it. And we're hoping that will take 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah, thank you.
Finalised.
Okay, and ultimately, when once finalised, you as the chief executive will be ultimately responsible for implementing it.
If we could talk about a freshwater farm plan, it still has to go through the certification process, so we need to bring our certifier in to go through and make sure it's to the certain standard of certification. I wouldn't expect it could be, but it's going to be by a balanced environmental plans.
And do you think a farm plan could be less effective in terms of how its development and the responsibility for implementation of it if it covers multiple farming activities that are separately managed by different people?
I think the duck stops with me. At the end of the day, and I keep good outside of it from when we have start employees the same. So we keep everything stops and starts with us, I suppose.
Yeah, and if we're talking about a different farm where the buck stops with different people, do you think it might be more challenging to implement a single farm environment plan?
It shouldn't be. I think it's very achievable.
Okay, no questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Hurst. I'm a lawyer for DOC, so my questions are around stock excursion. That's the main one of the key field points for the Director General. But my questions for you all relate entirely to this farm environment plan. So, and really just around some clarity, just to get an understanding of these things. I'm not a farmer, so I do appreciate your help there. With regards to the farm environment plan, if we can just go to page 56, and that's appendix 11. Just wanted to verify. So this appendix and plan identifies permanent waterways, ephemerals, home block and intensive winter grazing. And so I'm reading this correctly, is it, you've got your intensive winter grazing coloured in that tan colour, and then the ephemeral, which is kind of like that purpley colour. So is that correct that you have ephemerals going through the middle areas that are intensively winter grazed?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. How does that work? Well, I'm appreciating the South category.
Well, we'll have them fenced off. So they're
sorry,
like
you have them fenced off, did you say?
Well, temporary fence, like a critical source area.
Right.
So we'll meet the national regulations. So
we've
got to remember this. This is more of a historical thing. So these were our original water grazing areas. We tend to do the steep of the country, but with the change to the national regs, we've gone to more of the lower slope maps. There's lower slope paddocks. So, but so we typically wouldn't be winter grazing on most of those steep areas.
Anymore.
So that was the switch. And we're very conscious farmers that we will temporary fence off those critical source areas, and we might sow them out in winter grazing crop. We'll leave them in the pasture.
Okay, so do you have buffers or do you use fences instead?
We'll have a buffer. I'll
Is that a challenge? Is that a challenging task for you as a farmer to do that?
Oh, no, I think it's the right thing to do. It's obviously that it's well recognised in the winter grazing management processes that we've had in this, you know, in the South Island.
Thank you.
Just to clarify, that's temporary electric fencing, just for electric standards.
Yeah.
As we do with brochure.
So I guess where I'm coming from is, as you will appreciate, the Director General is seeking measures to reduce, you know, the contaminants going into water bodies like ephemerals, like permanent water bodies. And so the concerns, particularly from the farming interests, is that it's not practical to be fencing these areas and it's quite expensive. But what I'm hearing from you is that actually it's not. Is that correct?
Well, you've got to remember it's in the winter and
yeah.
it's only in my small percentage of the farm.
Right.
So it's a bespoke solution for that particular category at that particular time.
Right.
And it's typically in the weather part of the year, it is in the weather part of the year.
Yes, yeah, the winter. But I guess the point has to be made that it's achievable to do that.
Yeah, well, this is temporary fencing. It's just a standard thing we put up. It doesn't take much time. It's no cost at all. It's just the cost, you know, half an hour to put it up, take it down.
And so the permanent fencing, is more of an issue?
Oh, it's come to a significant cost.
The
permanent fencing comes with a significant cost, and then there's the issues with it getting washed away, flooding, and that sort of stuff. So
the temporary is a solution to those challenges, is that correct to say? Doing temporary fencing as opposed to permanent would be the ideal solution to the challenges of permanent fencing?
Remember, this is a winter grazing situation, so we're fencing off, given daily shifts, so we're moving an electric fence every day. So it's just a matter of not moving the fence into the critical source areas in this situation.
Thank you for that. So I just wanted to just look at Appendix 3 of that farm environment plan. Just wanting to understand, because the federals are here and there, and then of course Appendix 3 links back to the new action list at page 5. Is that your understanding?
I think so.
Yep. So we've got quite a few federals and permanent water bodies in there. When you see ephemerals, it seems to be in the, is it the home rolling and the home arable dryland areas? That's correct.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. And so if we go then to page 5, it then sets out the action list. Appreciating this little graph. And so with regards to home rolling and home arable country, it's like on page 5, the third row down, it then talks, go across to the risk description, the rolling contours in this area means that flow paths will develop in wet conditions, this can transport contaminants directly to waterways if there is no buffer in place, it's identified as a high risk, talks about water bodies. And then just in the next column over is to identify critical source areas when cultivating and grazing and leave suitable vegetative buffer strips between these areas and waterways. Is that what you're doing?
Yep.
Yeah. And the practicalities around doing that?
Probably just more to do with the permanent grazing act, because that is veered off through the winter if we don't, and if there's veer land that will erode. Typically when we're sowing more of a crop, that established autumn crop, that gets well developed when it comes, so the plants will hold it all together and they're inclined to cause erosion and then get wetter.
Right. So there's kind of a multi-purpose to the buffering, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. That's useful and makes things more practicable.
Yep.
And so, if I then go and look at page 34, which will council identify, which is the waterways and riparian management, interested in the good farming practice principles. And just, I've asked similar questions of the council's planner around, so you've got identified risk of overland flow and sediment and fecal bacteria on the property. And then it says, implement measures to minimise transport of these to water bodies. What kind of measures would you see apply there in terms of that principle?
Yeah, I suppose it's limiting the stock for those areas, but I remember we're a mixed arable farm, so we have more cropping on our farm, so that's most of it.
Okay. So is that the other measures is limiting stock?
Yes. And I think it's the time of the year as well, is important. The class of stock we run on there as well. And obviously the slope and trying to understand how that interacts with the water bodies as well.
Okay, so once you work all that out, what type of measures would that result in terms of this practice of principle? Good timing practice?
Well, I think at the time of the year it's really important is that it tends to be a weird time of the year, we take a lot more notice what's going on because the soil is a lot more high moisture and tend to flow off more, so we'll possibly a bit more bespoke power manager stock. If it's a dry part of the year, it's less inclined to get water runoff and all this sort of stuff because the soil soaks up the rain. So that depends on the weather as well.
So what would you use if it is raining? What measures would you use?
Well, the other thing, we will remove our stock from some of those areas that we have to be wet. We've got quite a broad range of soil types, so we'll take them. We might not always get there, but certainly if it's wet, we'll move them to an area that's a bit flatter, I suppose.
Right, away from water bodies? Or?
Yep.
So those are the types of measures you would implement, that's what you envision, and it talks about that in the good farming practices. And so with the next one, locate and manage farm tracks, gateways, water troughs, self-feeding areas, stock camps, wallows, and what I'm interested is in other sources of run to minimise risk to water quality. So how does that minimise risk to water quality, though?
We'll take farm tracks, for example. We can actually make sure the farm tracks are contoured so they don't run into the waterway, because typically they just make sure that how the culverts all sort of work. Make sure your gateways are well away from the waterway. You can typically hit them a little bit, but obviously it depends where your fences are. If you have your water troughs up on up on top of a flatter area, it's not particularly close to the waterway, and that's important because certainly it's down near the bottom of or near the waterway, they tend to all congregate there, and then it creates cramp and all that sort of stuff. So I think placing bush troughs is really good. Make sure your self-feeding areas, this is for your, if you're self-feeding with silage or feeding out the stock, make sure they're well away from the waterways. Stock camps that tend to be on the top of a ridge line, so that's quite a common thing there. That's the type of thing.
Right, okay. And sorry, finally, just in the third bullet point, it talks about where exclusion is not possible, mitigate impacts on waterways. So are you talking about much the same things there as well, when you say impact or mitigate impacts on waterways, is exclusion is an option?
Yeah, I suppose I've been farming all my life, and a lot of these things are really obvious to me, but quite often we don't actually write them down. But it's it's quite obvious where you've got... or you can move stuff around and just keep them away from the waterways, all that type of stuff. So I'm not exactly explaining very well, but
okay. All right.
Sorry, Councillor, just so I'm clear, because we already talked about excluding stock in the first part of that point. What are the other measures that you're talking about when you say exclusion is not possible, or removing them is not possible?
I think I answered that in the second bullet point, where I explained about farm tracks, about ways water crops, about creating new stock pens and that sort of thing. So that's just making sure they're located away from the waterways. That's considered to be sort of a good farming practice. There are different methods we can undertake. And the other, probably the key point is when it's really wet, we move them away if possible onto some areas of our farm. In our farm, we've got some green growing soils that it's really wet, that they don't tend to pug up as well. I think it's stock trampling, wet conditions, that type of thing. So we can move stock to certain areas that really wet periods. But of course, if we get big long periods of wet weather, it's not easy. And typically, it's wetter in winter, a lot wetter in winter.
So you might not have an answer to my final question, but you're well aware of Plan Change 1 as the first step toward giving effect to Te Tere Whaimana. Are you familiar with Te Tere Whaimana or not? I guess my question is just around, I appreciate you've provided this plan and it's from your property in South Canterbury, but I expect that there's no regard given to Te Tere Whaimana in this plan, because it's not South Canterbury,
isn't it?
It's not the Waikato.
I'm not familiar with
it. Yeah.
Just
a detail on that. Yeah, well, Te Tere Whaimana is about the health and well-being of the river and making it swimmable again and being able to gather food from it again in 80 years' time. And so my question as well, in terms of this farm environment plan, because it's for the South Canterbury, you wouldn't have factored those types of considerations into it?
Well, a little bit, because in my evidence I refer to the on the bottom farm, leads into Lake Wanao, which is a Kai for a local Renanga. So it's sort of
that.
So, and that property, we don't actually run stock there, so we've got we're going to riparian plantings, and we had a funded project to shore up the stream banks and rock armouring and that sort of thing to stop the stream bank erosion. So.
That's just that area of your property?
Yeah, on
not the other
on
areas?
Yeah.
All right, then. Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Thank you, sir.
So, clarification on your winter grazing and setbacks for ephemerals. Now, that's a winter cropping situation.
That's right.
Yeah. So, after it's grazed, the paddocks look very bare.
Oh, yes, it's bare soil, basically.
Okay. So, you'd see that as a different situation to something that might be typical of Waikato perennial ryegrass established for a number of years.
It's completely different situation. We're a cooler part of the country and things just don't grow much. That's why we need to have winter grazing, so we can be a stock that is basically be sort of winter plants. That's why it's really important that winter grazing is properly, and that's why we fence off those critical soil areas, because that's the sort of temporary buffer, I suppose. Well, that's basically what it is, a temporary buffer, because it feeds into the waterways. So that's how we mitigate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. No one can contour it here. Lockie, that's fine.
Mr. Hess, just in relation to the temporary fencing that you were talking about, what kind of distances, what areas are you talking about when you have to move that in the winter? How many kilometres?
It's only a few hundred metres. It's not much at all. Like, it's just, it would be nearly 100 metres. No, probably only 50 or 60, I suppose.
Thank you.
It's very minor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Game is on.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor.
again, Council here. Now you just get an answer to Ms. Tumai that you have a lagoon on your property, Wainono Lagoon, is it?
It's at the end of the waterway.
Right.
Yeah, so in my primary, in my units, it's a little net.
Yeah, okay. And I know that you aren't expected to be overly familiar with PC1, but PC1 has 80-year targets, and we're trying to achieve 20% towards those targets within 10 years, so you'll be aware of that.
Yes.
And some of the targets have yet to be established, and the council is going through a plan change in December 2024, like many other councils around the country, to establish these targets. And Fish and Game is particularly interested in targets relating to lakes. And the lake experts have been conferencing, and they've said that many lakes are going to require significant reductions in external nutrient loads to simply maintain current in-lake water quality. So first of all, you would agree, wouldn't you, that it's fair that those farmers within lake catchments are given the information up front about the extent of nutrient reductions that they're going to have to make over time in order to achieve these targets? Well, they're going to get a nasty surprise later, aren't they? So, all right. Now, are you familiar with the Ashburton Lakes report down in Canterbury?
Yes.
And so, are you also aware that in some areas where there are particular environments, for example, lakes, good management practices are not going to be sufficient to move towards the targets that we might need to achieve for healthy states? In some areas, good management practices are not going to be sufficient. There might need to be some land use changes.
Well, I would tailor reductions. It doesn't always go far enough sometimes.
Yeah.
But it depends on what we're talking about.
Okay. But is it your understanding, though, that in those areas where good management practices are not going to be enough, that there may need to be, for example, retirement of some land, reducing stocking rates, and other more significant changes if the water quality targets are going to be achieved in some areas?
Well, that's what we're faced in Canterbury. We've got our team changes there. We've got significant reductions by a step change through time.
Yep.
That reduction, nitrogen reductions have to happen, so that's what we're already faced with.
Okay.
Yep.
And down in Canterbury, are some farmers faced with changing their farming system or their farming type?
I'm not aware of any, but they will have to change their, or have advanced mitigation. Like, a dairy farm, you can do stand-off pads. Controlling your nitrogen applications to different times of the year, potentially reducing nitrogen applications. There's a whole raft of advanced mitigation possibilities.
Right.
Or more opportunities to make reductions.
Yeah. So just going back to my first question, if that was what you were ultimately going to be required to achieve, a farmer would want to know that now, wouldn't they? Rather than in a couple of years' time when the 2024 plan change goes through?
I'll perhaps answer it in a different way. Look, farmers have made significant improvements the way that we manage our farms over probably the last 5 years. And I don't think we've actually got to have a good understanding of what the impacts are. So it's a continual improvement with starting with our good management practices. And the thing about good management practices, they will continue getting moving to a higher standard, so over time, so as we learn more. And then there's these advanced mitigation opportunities as well, as I mentioned earlier. You know, we've got precision applications of fertiliser. We've got precision irrigation and those types of things. Yes. There's plantain, for example, is a good way to reduce nitrogen in dairy operation. There's things popping up all the time. As I mentioned, the advanced mitigation opportunities.
Okay. No, thank you. So, in your evidence, Federated Farmers is putting a lot of work into, and I'll call them the NPSFM plan changes, but they're the ones that at the current point in time need to be in by December 2024 or notified by then. So, Federated Farmers is putting a lot of work around the country into those plan changes?
Yeah, we're starting on the journey with that, so I think everybody realises that. Large body of work, especially for an organisation like Federated Farmers. We're just actually overwhelmed with how we're dealing with it. All the different regional councils around the country. In fact, we're wondering how we're going to resource it. And I imagine a lot of different organisations are facing the same sort of thing. So it's be kind of nice to actually spread it out over a period of years. We'd probably do 4 a year instead of all 16 in one.
My proposition is that if this is happening in the Waikato in the next year, it's counterintuitive to be granting even 15 consents, and I know you've seen your evidence that you would also like consents out to 25 years for some farms, because we're embarking on this new process of potential new limits. And that will undermine that process if we grant 15 or 25 year consents?
I think farmers need certainty with where they go. And you know, farms are quite valuable nowadays, and if you want to make investments to make advanced mitigation things, you need to have certainty to invest that money to make the changes. So I think it's a bit of a treadmill if we don't. Give farmers certainty. The example we have in Canterbury with the irrigation stuff, there's opportunities, as I said, precision irrigation, you know, that costs a lot of money, and then people won't invest. It's a vicious circle. I think you can have a long-term consent, like we've suggested, but just it could be depending on what the conditions are in those consents.
Like reviews or something?
Potentially.
Would you consider a scenario where consents in lakes catchments are granted for a lesser term simply because the information isn't currently in the plan at the moment about targets that will ultimately be required for those lakes catchments?
I don't think I can really answer that.
Alright. Thank you very much.
Horticulture New Zealand? No. Thank you.
Good reading.
Good observers. Just a few follow-up questions relating to the Federated Farmers position of some of the statements that are in your statement of evidence. You say in paragraph 84 you kind of set out having gone through a range of issues in terms of what all this means for PC1, Federated Farmers think that this points to the need for, and then you have a series of statements A through to F. And as I read through all of those, they seem to be, I would have thought, relatively consistent with what Federated Farmers' view is as to a national standard. So what you said in terms of what it means for PC1, you'd say the same key points for any part of the country, wouldn't you? Clarity certain about regulatory obligations, your view on consent durations, lowest level of red tape, unnecessary duplication should be removed, obligations should be staged, and councils should develop implementation and engagement plan. Those are all. That's a generic position, isn't it?
Without reading it
But the common themes that you'd be advancing in plan changes around the country, wouldn't you?
I believe so.
Thank you. And I just wanted to just build on that point for the Environment Conservation and Fishing Game mentioned to Tiri Whaimana, the vision and strategy for the Waikato River. And I think you fairly said you don't have a degree of intimate familiarity with its contents. But as a general proposition, that's an 80-year time frame in order to achieve a desired state of health and well-being for the river. And the key of PC1 is to, in the life of PC1, so within that 10-year frame, fast evaporating, to hit 20% of the targets, 20% of that journey. So you understand that as a general principle as well.
I'm very familiar with the 20% reduction in 10 years, yeah.
All right. And you're also aware of the status of Te Tiri Whaimana in terms of where it sits relative to national regulation, that if national regulation is inconsistent with Te Tiri Whaimana, then Te Tiri Whaimana and has a stronger provision, then that prevails.
I understand that.
Yeah. And so you'd accept it as a general proposition then that while obviously national standards do provide a level of uniformity in that regard, you accept that is a proposition. We're focused specifically here on the Waikato and that Te Tiri Whaimana can or may require standards that are higher than the national standards.
Yeah, I believe that's the same with any council in the country too.
Now, I did notice in terms of the lowest level of red tape necessary, that you said Federated Farmers seeks the least regulatory intervention needed to achieve the desired outcome. So, I mean, your qualification on that is a commitment to achieve the desired outcomes is obviously first and foremost, isn't it? So your comment about red tape is subject to that, isn't it?
Yes.
And here we've got that 20% target. And when I kind of looked across to some comments on Overseer, and I think you've rightly identified the concerns with Overseer and what it should or shouldn't be doing in that regard, and when you were dealing with talking about the Federated Farmers' position on Overseer in paragraph 76, and again this is a summary, and just note that, and this is a general proposition, not relevant, well I suppose related to the use of Overseer, Federated Farmers considers it's not appropriate to control nitrogen by focusing on the rate or quantum of nitrogen loss, but it's appropriate to control nitrogen by focusing on the risk of nitrogen loss. And then you go on later on in paragraph 77 to talk about managing farm activities, and you said any prioritisation in 77A should be of one contaminant over another should be based on water quality issues in a particular catchment or sub-catchment. And then you say in paragraph B, the diffuse discharges should be managed using a risk-based approach rather than an approach that seeks to manage diffuse discharges on the basis of farm-scale modelled nitrogen loss rates. And finally, farm plans should be the principal means for identifying and recording farm-specific risk. Now, I just kind of was trying to link all of those things up. Farm plans, focusing on risk rather than actual rates of quantum of nitrogen loss being assessed, but also the reference to water quality issues. Now, with that context, if we're talking about 20% target, those are targets that are water quality attributes relevant to the four contaminants. It just seems to me we do need to be doing something, don't we, beyond simply that kind of risk scorecard gateway test. But you actually, isn't it really important for farmers to also be able to ascertain once we're at that stage and judging and testing those 20% achievement levels as to what actually is occurring within each subcatchment and how that relates back to the on-farm activities? Do you think that's an important element of it?
So what are you actually asking me?
that it's important to be actually to be able to link those water quality measures and whether they've been achieved or not at the end of the PC1 immediate time frame, so that 20% target, if that has or hasn't been achieved, particularly if it hasn't been achieved, to be able to take that back and actually assess that against the actual farm activities that have or haven't been occurring in the relevant catchments. Do you think that's an important aspect of this plan change?
Well, it's a key, I think it's a farm management practice on those farms that if they're poor, they need poor quality, but if they're good or improving, they will make the difference. And I think that's what we're all hearing about today. And it's the bespoke nature of each individual farm is a little bit different. That's why it needs to be resourced and farm plans are the key to this, because it all stops and starts in the catchment. It doesn't matter what the rules are, it's the willingness of the landowner to get on with it and to make that change. We can have all the rules and under the sun, but if we don't get the willingness of the basically the whole community, that's why I'm a big fan of the catchment proof approach. It's this peer support from the members of the community to get these things done.
Yes, and I think that was kind of where I was leading to some extent, which is the importance of that community, catchment community or sub-catchment community, because obviously if we are dependent on individual farm plans and individual actions on farms, you do want an ability, I would suspect, as a farmer, to be able to judge at the end of that period if the targets haven't been met, to be satisfied you've done your share, and if it's fallen short, has anybody else been also performing to the required standards?
Yeah, I think the important part of the national standards of the National Fresh Water Fund is it brings into the catchment context, which is takes account of that cumulative effect. And this fund plan here, it's got a little bit of it in there, but still more work to do. But I think catchment context is actually crucial. How they all would regulate.
Yes, because you talk about that, looking at things from a risk-based approach, which I suppose is getting some categorisation, so where you fit. But then, obviously, if you're looking at success or needing to adjust things, you've talked about a lot of on-farm mitigation that maybe occurred that's necessary beyond simply going passing through the gateway and you sit within that realm. That's important, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is, and it also depends on how councils implement these things. I think it's a big responsibility on regional council to get on and implement the
it's a beautiful segue to the last point, which was your observation about why the regional council needs to develop an implementation and engagement plan. And I wonder whether it's almost, and maybe that's what you meant by implementation, but it's fundamental, isn't it, that for farmers to have confidence in the system to actually be able to actually see what those water attribute states are within each sub-catchment on a regular basis, to have that information being assessed by the regional council to be fed back into the catchment and for the farmers, so that you're not simply finding out in 10 years' time or something to change things, but to be able to react, I suppose, in a timely and efficient basis through the course of a consent, even if a consent might be 15 years. You don't want to wait until the end of the 15 years to change or to mitigate those adverse effects.
I totally agree. I think the worst thing we have is a tick box exercise for just that needs to be a living document. And as I said earlier, the whole catchment works together, including the regulator. Anybody in the community that's got an interest in water should be involved in those processes. So it's probably going a little bit. What I'm talking about, a non-statutory process where there's a willingness from the whole community to work together.
Sure. And presumably, I'm not sure what the relationship between the farmers at a regional level is, but then there's working with iwi, and you do work with the local runanga in Ngaitahu in terms of
definitely
those mahi makai and other important aspects of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your interest.
Any re-examination?
No, thank you, sir. the assist this process. I'm just interested in, by way of background, I'm a little bit familiar with the area that you come from, and having done a little bit of work in the one I was doing some years ago for a client. Looking at your Appendix 3 in the balance farm plan that was done for you, Appendix 3 and 4, just looking at those land units and your different waterways that you've been directed to a couple of times, the permanent waterways, ephemeral waterways, swales. Is that information that you provided to the balance in terms of classifying those? What those streams were like?
Initially, but I've still got to tidy them up a little bit more. We need to add some in and take some away, so they just made a quick assessment, so this is what I'm going to have to set the draft. So, and the thing is that home lock is it's quite a rolling farming, so there'll be, yeah.
So that your home block is up on the downs?
Yep, rolling down.
Seems the sleeways are up on the downs.
Yeah.
Smooth rolling land,
yeah,
and then the purple block you've got there, that's down on the low.
Yeah, that's basically flat, heavy, plain country.
So, what do you mean, if you've given balance this information, what do you mean by an ephemeral waterway? What's your definition that you're working to?
Well, it's a sort of flow path, it's a gully without any, and it basically only flows when it rains. So essentially that home block, it just flows when it rains. It basically, there's no spring bed, and it's quite short catchments, even though we have to find banks. So I think that bottom one there, it does say it's permanent, the light blue line, but in reality it is very intermittent. It's only if we get a runoff rain or event, it will flow. So it's got a defined bank.
I was sort of struck by the fact that you've got permanent waterways there, ephemeral waterways, but not intermittent. So I sort of, there's a continuum, and ephemeral will become an intermittent, will become a permanent stream.
There's more work to do to get there.
So
basically, I just landed in my email hot box last Thursday, and I produced it to Zero Farms. I thought it's quite important. I bought it here today. So
it's been very helpful to give us an idea of what a farm environment plan
looks
like.
It's actually surprising how comprehensive it is, so I'm quite impressed with it actually.
Okay. All right. Yeah, thanks for that. Thanks for those clarifications.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hurst, and thank you for me as well. I thought the document was very comprehensive as well, so I was a little bit surprised at the time it didn't contain. How extensive is mitigated use in the Canterbury area?
I'm uncertain. I just happen to have balance as a fair loss company. We deal with both. So I've had to pay for this. So, or it does come with the cost.
That was going to be my next question. What sort of dollar numbers are we talking about? If you don't mind.
So, to date, it's $10,080 to produce that. At $210 an hour, and that includes the overseer. And it's plus $680 for the overseer in charge. And we've got a bit of our own time, myself and my sons, and it could be up to about $1,500 for our own time. So it's around about $12,000, somewhere in there. So that's just getting the plan developed. And when I've been keen to turn into a freshwater farm plan, it requires to be certified by a certifier. I'm uncertain what that might cost. That could be up to a couple of $1,000, I presume, because they want to go under the very little bit of thing we've got there in the act, and then they develop the actions and the time frames to achieve them, and then they'll have to be audited as well, so they'll come under cost as well. So I just put a rough figure to do all that, it could be up to $20,000.
Okay. Just taking that a step further, if everyone is using the same format and a lot of the information was common to all of them,
your legal description and then if adjacent possessions of the owner, and it looks to the list like perhaps it looks to the it probably looks to the regional council, which will work out where some of the waterways are, which maybe where we've got to. But it still needs to be ground truth, so that's probably where the cost comes.
Well, that's helpful, thank you. And when you come to do your next one, say in 5 years or whatever, that would be a much lower cost again, or not?
I think so. We've got to remember this is a sort of on a larger side of the plant, so this
right.
is 750-year-old farm, and it's, typically with us, it's probably the size of about three small farms. So it's a sort of larger size. So.
No, that's pretty helpful, thank you. Do you know if there's any work being done in Canterbury on risk scorecards comparable and dry stock funds?
It's part of my interest, and I've become familiar with what's happening in Waikato because I certainly think it's got possibilities. But in Canada, we did have a thing called the N-check, which was a simple version to determine whether you're permitted or not. And that was a few years ago, so you put in some stocking rates, these crop areas, and also put your farm size on there. So that was for the end of it yourself. So that's what we had in Canterbury, is a sort of draft and gap. It was quite a crude process as opposed to the nitrogen risk scorecard, but I like that approach of what's happened here, and I think it's something because you can put to do it yourself. And then it's all cool. We did have a little bit of that. I helped the council out when we developed some regional plans, and we developed a narrative. This is when we're going through all the struggles with overseer and changing overseers. We developed a narrative, drafting gate, and it was in relation to areas of irrigation. And if you're over, I can't remember the exact amount, you had to be a consented farmer. And the other threshold trigger was the area of winter grazing. So we went to meet over those two numbers. I can't remember the exact numbers, you become FDA consented farmer. Because it was really complicated when we first started in Canterbury. We had overseer numbers. If you were over a certain number, you had to get a consent to farm, and that got real tricky with changing overseer numbers and all that sort of stuff. So that's what we've been away from in Canterbury.
Okay, thank you. I noticed you don't have a consent limit on your nitrogen discharge. Would that be correct?
So I haven't got it on the permit activities farmer, so I always often been fitting under the threshold.
Because
I was plan change 3 of the Canterbury Land and Water Regional Plan, so that was quite a bespoke thing, and I think I'll talk about it later, so I had quite a bit to do with the development of that. But the other later plan change, the early ones were based on overseer limits, and the later ones were based on the narrative, so it was all a bit bespoke. In Canterbury, it's kind of complicated. So we're wondering where we're going to go next.
Okay, and do you have any requirements to reduce your nitrogen discharge? Or
no, because we're sort of low anyway. On the
right. Okay, so thank you. And one last point of clarification, picking up on what Mr. Pennell asked you about the comparability of what you do in terms of riparian strips in Canterbury and not being automatically transferred to the Waikato because of the different conditions, growing conditions and things like that.
Yeah, I think so. We're slide dry, and typically not a lot of slant. We're typically a lot drier, not a lot drier.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to check. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Hurst, you've given us some evidence about your role in Federated Farmers, and you've got these the section at the end with a number of statements about Federated Farmers' position, and maybe you have said this and I have not read it the same way. I just want to be clear about the extent to which you are telling us a policy position of the national organisation, or the extent to which you are telling us maybe a Canterbury view or a separate view.
I see.
It is the national policy position. Very good. So
us about, for example, the approach to oversee that it's a national position?
Yes, we haven't necessarily got to in Canada yet or any other country.
Okay.
It's been focused up here in Waikato.
Sure. Were you involved at all in the Southland regional plan process?
No, not me.
Anything arising from the court? No, thank you very much for your evidence. I think that's all we have scheduled today, Ms. Edwards. Ms. Matheson?
Yes.
All right, very good. Is there anything else that any person thinks we can usefully do with the time we have available, or should we adjourn early and return tomorrow morning at 9:30? Nothing further? No? All right, we'll adjourn till 9:30. Thanks, everyone.
The sitting of the Environment Court is adjourned until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow.
Thank you, everyone.
Good old Russian tank, right? Makes it.